Talking about 2020 protests in Belarus, I hope everybody heard about this. This was, I think, the biggest wave of uprising against the dictatorship in the country, against Alexander Lukashenko dictatorship, with several hundred thousand people participating in those protests in different parts of the country. What happened before that, before the protests, there was a small build-up, and one of the key factors of that build-up was a coronavirus pandemic. Even though in Belarus, this was one of the few countries where pandemic was not officially acknowledged, and like coronavirus was considered just a flu that you can, you know, send off with vodka and driving tractors. But in general, like, the virus was there and it was heavily influencing the society. So a lot of, let's say, care infrastructure for the people who are sick with coronavirus or the medical services were actually organized by different, let's say, self-organized groups. So you have like a very massive network of people providing, as I was saying, help to the neighbors or providing help to the medical personnel that was working in the hospitals, while at the same time the state was saying, don't worry, there is no coronavirus. If you have like a flu, just go back to work, and so on and so forth. It had an economical reasons. Belarus would be like completely collapsing if there would be a lockdown. So Lukashenko had to push it through. But for Belarusian people, this was very challenging. And this also created a huge space between like society and the state. Because Belarusian dictatorship was for very long advertising itself as like a social dictatorship. Belarusian dictatorship was taking care of its people, right? But this was the time when everybody figured out, okay, actually we're a dictatorship where the regime doesn't fucking care about anybody, right? So people got quite angry and frustrated through that process. And at the end of the day, we had like all these self-organized groups that were full of anger against the regime. So they were like not really explicitly political, but they were political in the sense of hating Lukashenko and hating what Lukashenko was doing during the coronavirus. And then what happens next is that Lukashenko, in this wave of coronavirus and wave of self-organizing, announces that there will be election round in summer 2020, and this mobilized quite a big chunk of the people who were actually already dissatisfied with corona handling to join the political struggle. Traditionally, like, although Belarusian elections are always falsified, it is still like a period of time of high intensive political organizing for a lot of people in the country. And 2020 was like an explosion of that. There were thousands and thousands of people in different cities where before maybe there was not even oppositional activity, who were organizing like different events, mobilizing people. And also in summer 2020, before even the elections, there were first clashes with the police when the cops were trying to arrest, like, let's say, illegal, so-called illegal actions, and people would try to de-arrest. So you would have first fist fights with the cops, and the cops were very surprised. So it created like a certain stage for the further development. And at the day of election on 9th of August, people went on the streets like all around the country, and this was very crucial. So instead of focusing on the capital and the big cities, the people in the smaller cities stayed in those cities and went to the squares in that towns, and this created a situation where in Minsk, the capital of Belarus, there were maybe several thousand of people on the streets, maybe 10,000 of people on the streets, but all around the country there were like dozens of thousands of people, and there were places where the police was completely overwhelmed. So the regime had to withdraw from the streets and completely give it to the protesters. So like that was the first night of the protest. However, in the bigger cities, the violence escalated very fast, with people from one side like fighting against the police, de-arresting people, and on the other side, police, Belarusian riot police, who had no prior experience with the big clashes, with the big demonstrations, had to use like within, I think, like half an hour or 1 hour, they used most of the gear that they bought in the last 20 years. So starting from the rubber bullets, ending up with like these cars that are building mobile shields and barricades on the streets, which was insane, and it was also showing that the cops were like very frustrated and they didn't know. They were like, hey, let's drop this thing on them and see if they are running away or not. And also because of those clashes and because of the frustration of the cops, there was a lot of violence against the people who were detained that days. So people would be detained on the street just walking around, not directly in action. And this would lead, like, if you are ending up in the police station, to you beaten up or then beaten up in the custody, in the pretrial prison, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of violence, and this lasted for 3 days. So for 3 days, people all around the country were going on the streets very, like, proactively building up barricades, fighting with the cops, taking over certain places in their cities, with over 6,000 people arrested those first 3 days. And this created, like, a lot of pressure on, in general, the population, because for Belarusian society, this was, I think, first time in many years, when the confrontation between the state and this, and the social organizing, the people, escalated to the extent where the state started slowly crumbling, and there was a hope that the dictatorship will fall apart. However, after 3 days, the protests went pretty fast down. So on the fourth day, there was no protest at all. And then slowly the new type of protest started building up, like the peaceful protest, where people would go to the streets with, like, flowers, maybe like peace signs and all the stuff, trying to prevent any further escalation from the police. So for people, it was very important, for some groups of people, it was very important to de-escalate the situation. Whether it worked or not, we can see today, but that de-escalation actually helped a lot the regime to kind of cool down the situation in the country and slowly start figuring out how to deal with the protesters, how to actually destroy the movement against the regime. The protest was not only, like, in one form, but rather there were so many different groups and people who were organizing it that the peaceful protests turned into, like, weekly marches on Sundays, where people would go to the streets and just walk around and have some kind of a festive atmosphere. It was a little bit bizarre, because it was a feeling of, like, okay, a victory in the situation where there is no victory yet. So people were celebrating victory against Lukashenko, as some liberals were saying, okay, Lukashenko is not going to survive that crisis, there is no fucking way. Maybe in liberal books it's written, you know, that dictatorship cannot survive that, but reality is very different. However, it mobilized quite a lot of people. So at the height of the protest, of this peaceful protest, there were, like, around 500,000 people on the streets all around the country. And Belarus, just to give you an estimation, is the country of 2 million is a country of 9.5 million people, and Minsk is 2 million people. So in Minsk you had, like, a march of 300,000 people, meaning that, like, every fifth person in the city was on the streets. Of course, there were people coming from the satellite cities, but in general, like, the participation of the society was incredible. And also there were protests in the places, like, where any kind of social organizing was never recorded before, right? Like, in written history, people never went to the streets to protest. This was the year where those cities, like, marked themselves as politically and socially active. There were also a lot of women on the streets, and this was kind of very important for general atmosphere for the protest. Women played a very important role in that, and they had also separate marches. So you would have, like, on Sunday this peaceful march, but one day before that there were women marches that were quite often more escalative than this peaceful marches. So the women were actually given, like, to the rest of the Belarusian society, you know, kind of like lessons how to proactively protest, how to resist the police arrest, and so on and so forth. And that was very fascinating, because in general, like, the Belarusian society is very patriarchal, very, like, very dominant in the way of relationship between men and women. Apart from women, there were other, like, let's say, social groups that were participating in the protests. There were students who were on the streets, there were workers who went on the streets, there were even, like, retired people who are normally, among whom there is, like, the biggest chunk who are voting for Lukashenko for stability and bullshit. Like, all the different slices of the society went to the streets, from, like, very young, very poor, up to older, maybe richer people who were thinking that, okay, the time of Lukashenko have passed. There was also a partial strike in the country, which was, like, also very exciting, but also very new, as in Belarus, workers do not strike for political reasons. There are certain strikes from time to time because you don't get a salary paid, and then you get paid at the end of the day. But like wild strikes with the political demands was, I think, didn't happen in Belarus for the last 20 years. And the workers that were demanding the release of the political prisoners and Lukashenko's withdrawal from the whole presidency candidacy and new round of elections. Yeah, the strikes were crashed with a lot of workers actually kicked out from the working places, those who were politically organizing, and in general, Belarusian regime here used the strategy of the Soviet times where the political organizers are like picked out of the crowd and punished quite heavily. Like you can get a crime, like a crime record or basically crime prosecution for those activities. Also, people who were, let's say, frustrated with the peaceful direction of the protests, or people who were participating in the peaceful protests but then thought, okay, we need to do something more, started doing direct actions. And in this case, by direct actions, I mean like actions against the property of the state, like destroying police cars, attacking police stations, and so on and so forth. And those were not your typical anarchist, anti-fascist groups, leftist groups, but rather like very simple people who never like were in such a high level, in any level of confrontation maybe with the state, apart from being drunk on the street and talk to the cop, you know? And those people were organizing online all the time, like figuring out, okay, how is like, what is the most effective way to burn down the car, or how to make Molotov cocktails? And you had like Telegram channels where people were exchanging that information, and those were not activists. Those were like just simple people who were like, well, I've seen this awesome YouTube video, check it out. And then the others like, yeah, awesome, I would think that we can add also this and this to Molotov cocktail to make it more effective. So it's like also crowd sourcing the whole idea of resistance. The other interesting part that was happening in those days was that people, because also of the COVID times, started organizing neighborhood assemblies where you would have like, I don't know, a neighborhood of, let's say, 50,000 people having assemblies of different activists who would come to the streets and see how they can organize together against the regime. So some of them were very politicized assemblies where you would have people making political proclamations. There was even like one neighborhood that proclaimed independence from Belarus and stuff like that. There were other neighborhood assemblies that were doing cultural events, and they were doing like just building up a social glue between the neighbors, which was also very nice. And this created something very new for the whole Belarusian society that was like, you know, destroyed by the Soviet times, destroyed by the Russian Empire, then destroyed by the Belarusian regime. So Belarusian people are not really, you know, talkative to each other. We talk about politics at the kitchen, as it was in the Soviet times, and rarely with our neighbors. And this created, first time in very long history of the country, a situation where people broke that, you know, fear and broke the fear of the state interfering in their communication. Yeah. Unfortunately, the protests were suppressed by February 2021. The biggest protest stopped already in November, I believe, with, well, a lot of people arrested. Unfortunately, we didn't win. It's not like we think, okay, we completely lost, we should give up, Lukashenko is eternal, but rather like we see that as a loss in a longer history of the fights. Like the uprising, this was the biggest uprising against Lukashenko, of course, but the struggle against the regime continues, even though that wave of the protests is down. Talking about consequences of those protests, like negative consequences, there were around 20 people who were killed in one way or another by the regime. One thing what was happening was that the cops were directly shooting people on the streets in the first days of the protests, with at least one person like shot at point blank by the special task forces, Belarusian, like a anti-terrorist squad. Then there were also people who were arrested, severely beaten up in the police stations, and then they were like, I mean, tortured to death pretty much. But because the police cannot report, oh, we killed someone in the police station, they would take the bodies of those people, bring them like to the forest, drop them in the river, and try to say this was a suicide. So you would have like a person who's like damaged by the torture, and he would be brought to the forest, hanged, and then the police would say, oh, he hanged himself because he was like very desperate. There are right now three people who died in prison, who were like politically prosecuted and died in prison because of the health issues, or there is at least one case where the person seems like to be beaten up by the police, by the prison guards to death. So the, let's say, mortality of this protest continues to grow because the regime doesn't stop the repressions even against the people who are already prosecuted and sitting in jails. There were also people who died because of COVID. And this is also an interesting story. In Belarus, COVID was weaponized by the Belarusian government. And that's not like, you know, a conspiracy theory where they were putting like bombs and throwing it, but rather Belarusian regime, or Belarusian, let's say, repressive part of the regime was understanding the value of people being sick. So the sick person is not participating in the protests. And what was happening is you would get arrested and you would get put in the cell for 15 days. Like, this would be the basic punishment for participating in the protest. You would get 15, 25 days in prison, and there would be like thousands and thousands of people sitting in different parts of the country. And they would have, of course, in that crowd, people who are sick with COVID. What would they do then is that you would have a person in the cell, sick with COVID, spreading COVID in the cell because it's a very tight room. They would take that person then and move it to another room, and then to another room, to another room, to spread COVID pretty much again, like around all the protesters. So when the people get out of the prison after serving 15 days in prison, they would be like completely sick, and they would need also weeks to recover. That means they are like kicked out from the protest, they can't participate in anything. And that was a very effective strategy, because in November 2020, there was like another rise of the COVID cases, and one of the reasons why there were like the pretty huge decline in amount of people on the streets was that a lot of people were sick with COVID. Like, you just talk to the people who were participating with you, or you know, who were participating on the streets, and they're saying, fuck, I can't breathe, you know, like I can't walk, I'm not going to show up to the protest. So Belarusian regime understood the value of that, and they were using that on the like constant basis to get people sick with COVID to prevent them from participating in the uprising. There are over 2,300 political prisoners at this moment in Belarus, at least 2,300, because it is kind of a very strange dynamic where certain people don't want to be listed as political prisoners and don't want to get in touch with the political structures that do solidarity work, or don't want to get in touch in general with anybody who would say, oh, you were prosecuted for political reasons, because they believe this can bring extra pressure on you. So they believe that, okay, being political is actually extra complicated to be in prison. And also, this number, for example, differs from the number we have from like Belarusian human rights organizations, as those do not consider quite a lot of people political prisoners because they used violence against police, for example, or against state authority representatives. And for the human rights defenders, this is like a no-go. Like, you use violence, this is already like excludes you from being political prisoner. And this is like, I think, guidelines of Amnesty International and all those organizations that are living in some very magic bubble where violence is considered to be like a horrible thing against the state and against the people who are killing you. In the last years, since 2020, most of the Belarusian, like, let's say all of the Belarusian independent media was shut down with, there were in the first place not so many of those medias, but in general, like, even this small pool of the medias that were working to highlight the problems of the Belarusian society, they were kicked out. But they were not just shut down and like, okay, that's it. Rather, they were criminalized. So quite a lot of medias are now considered extremist formations in Belarus, and I will talk about that in a minute. But in general, like, it's basically criminalization of media, of journalist work in Belarus that is happening on the consequential basis. And this is basically leads to the situation where a lot of media outlets do not have any journalists in the country at all, because they are concerned that this can lead to more political prosecution of those journalists. We also have situation where all, let's say, like not connected with the Belarusian regime NGOs were shut down, even the ones that were not explicitly political. So, for example, an NGO that was working on the protection of the bird diversity in the country, that was getting some finances from the European Union, ecological foundations, and so on and so forth, they were shut down, and so on. Like the whole list of basically like organizing around ecology, feminism, human rights, and so on and so forth, like all of that was criminalized again. And this was an important part and a message from the an important part of the repressions and a message from Belarusian regime to the society that we are not going to tolerate anything organized not by us. So we are not going to tolerate any activity from the society that is not controlled by the Belarusian state. And to give you an example of that, there is still a Belarusian Red Cross. So this is not like a state organization, but the organization has officially like appointed chief by the Belarusian state, and the organization is like proactively supporting war in Ukraine, supports Belarusian police. They were like in 2020 they were collecting money for example for the people who were suffering from the violence on the streets, and those money went to the police. So this kind of like activity is okay because this is completely under control of the Belarusian state, but everything that is not like controlled by that is not in order in any way. Yeah, this I will skip. Talking about legislations, is Belarusian regime, Belarusian dictatorship is a very bizarre thing. And I think it's not only Belarusian dictatorship, but a lot of the modern dictatorship try to somehow justify their repressions. You know, like in the old days, the king says we should cut their heads, end of story, right? In the modern days, the king can't say that. The king can say, there is a law that allows us to cut the heads of the specific people who did this and this. And that's what Belarusian regime is doing pretty much. They're creating the list, like they're expanding the legislations on prosecution of the political opponents that would allow them to do quite a lot of different ways of repressing people. First of all, Belarus is like the last country that has actively death punishment, death penalty in Belarus. So people are getting executed by a shot in the head in Belarus. And this is one of the things that is like very threatening to a lot of protesters. And Belarusian regime is actually threatening people who are against the regime with that. First thing to talk about is extremism. In general, extremism, the fight against so-called extremism is happening all around the world. It's like a, let's say, a holy cow of the state repressions. The belief that there is a certain, like, not proper way to fight back against like repression apparatus, against the state authoritarianism, and so on and so forth. The state puts the claim that this is extremism, and then you are good to go. Like you can fucking destroy the organizations, you can destroy social movements that you mark as extremist. And within the liberal paradigm, this is fine. Belarusian regime was working for quite long with the European Union. From 2015 to 2020, European Union was like dropping a lot of money into Belarusian state. And one of the reasons why Belarusian state got interested in extremism was that they need justification for repressions. They couldn't just repress people under false pretext. They would use extremism. And it was like a very easy article to censor certain medias, destroy certain publications, and so on and so forth. It was enough to end up like on the list of banned, let's say, literature, so your books or your brochures wouldn't be distributed in any open space. Yeah, but this was like a light version of fight against the extremism. And in 2020, it went like full fucking scale. Like they just thought, okay, extremism, let's go on this toy. And they modified quite a bunch of laws. One of the laws was created that would create this notion of the extremist formation, which is basically like a criminal, organized criminal organization, which normally is like a criminal punishment, criminal prosecutable group. And in Belarus, to become extremist formation, it's enough for the police to decide that. So the cop is sitting in his fucking room and he's doing, you know, like picking buggers from his nose and thinks what I'm going to do today. And then he has a list of anarchist, anti-fascist, liberal organizations that are opposing, and he's just doing check boxes. There is no control, there is no oversight to understand which ones are extremist formations. And then the next day, they can raid your flats, they can arrest people, and so on and so forth. Being part of the extremist formation is punishable up to 5 years in prison. Being an organizer of an extremist formation is like up to 6 years. Financing extremist formation is also something like 4 or 5 years. So they got like a very easy way to prosecute pretty much everybody they don't like, and they're using that law very intensively. So apart from anarchist organizations that are included in that list, as I was saying, NGOs and a lot of media newsletters were included in the extremist formation list, but also organizations that are doing solidarity work. So for example, like liberal organizations that were collecting money to help families of those who ended up in prison, those would be also considered extremist formations, and donations to them is becoming automatically prosecutable. So if you donate an extremist formation, you can get also like 4 or 5 years in prison. And this kind of cooled down the wave of solidarity of the Belarusian people who were like donating fucking crazy amount of money, you know, like they were donating way more than a lot of Western Europeans to support their comrades. Yeah. And then they started passing laws even further, like there is a possibility to revoke your citizenship for extremism. There is prosecutable, like further on going to terrorism prosecutions. But in general, like extremism became a very easy way out for the Belarusian regime to justify any prosecution of anybody, pretty much. In Belarus, it is also forbidden to call for sanctions. We actually, like as ABC Belarus, met some anarchists and some liberals in Europe who are saying, oh, the sanctions are, you know, like harming Belarusian people. It is all complete bullshit. Sanctions are working and they are fucking destroying Belarusian regime, because Belarusian regime is heavily dependent on a lot of things from all around the world. And for us as, let's say, people who are trying to bring down the regime, fuck it. I mean, it can be just rubbles and stones left. We will rebuild the world that we were building under fucking oppression. So we are not afraid that the Belarusian state will collapse. So don't try to stop sanctions against Belarus. And don't start to stop sanctions against Russia. Those are working and they are quite good. And we all love when the rich people whine that their villas are getting confiscated. The other thing is that in Belarus, for very long, death sentence was used only for very specific cases of like extreme violence, extreme sadistic murders, and so on and so forth. But recently, the law was passed that would allow to execute people not only for performing terrorist actions, but also for intention of terrorist actions. So if you are like planning some terrorist attack, and then the cops figure it out, then potentially they can they can sentence you to life, or they can prosecute you and murder. This was connected with the protests against the war in Ukraine, and I will talk about that in a moment. But in general, like the Belarusian state is adapting and becoming way more brutal in this legal sphere, right? So there was no legal sphere that would give possibility to torture people and kill them in the police stations, but now they are creating more and more possibilities to do that without any consequences for them. Talking about new repression tactics, this was also something that the Belarusian regime had to adapt itself to, because in general, the opposition was maybe a couple of thousands of people, and suddenly you have like hundreds of thousands of people on the streets, and they had to figure out how to try to, you know, like put water on the fire of that uprising. One of the things that was very popular is basically they would torture a person, then put them in like a police room, take a camera and film this person who is like after torture saying, I'm very sorry for participating in the protests. I'm like denying any political ideology and so on. And they would put that online saying, oh, look at those protesters. They are fucking weak assholes. They don't know what they want. And this was a very important strategy for Belarusian state from one side to show your comrades are weaklings and they're not capable of standing up to torture. But then they would also use those videos on the state media TV. So like my grandma would be checking her TV and she would be seeing tortured people on this video, and that would be completely fine in the new reality of the Belarusian state, where they would be saying, oh, we are sorry. And this was an important message from the regime to the society, to the, like, let's say, pro-regime forces, that everything is under control. Don't worry. Look, they're already crumbling. They're already getting destroyed. And there were like thousands and thousands of those videos. They were putting them on Telegram, on YouTube, the police. And these days, like, most of those videos are actually deleted because the accounts of the police, Belarusian police, were banned in most of the social networks. But yeah, the amount of videos that were filmed in those first several months were incredible, and they're still continuing to do that. So Belarusian, like, political police or Belarusian normal police has their own Telegram channels from time to time. So they, like, create a new one again and again, and there you see new videos popping up again with the beaten up people who are, have to admit their fault in participating in the protests 3 years ago. Belarusian regime also normalized use of torture as a, let's say, a mechanism against the opponents. Before, let's say, torture was a very subtle, like, it was used in somewhere under the carpet that nobody would know that so much violence is used by the state. And to give you an example, Belarusian state was, like, for example, systematically using violence against the prisoners. So you would have riot police going to the prisons and actually exercising on the prisoners how to beat up people and do the crowd control and all the stuff. And that was something that was not really present in the media, because for liberal media, for oppositional media, you don't have contacts with the prisoners. You don't have contacts with, like, people who are from very marginalized groups. So this information was not popping up. But then after 2020, because of this massive amount of people who were on the protests, the violence just spilled across all the social groups, across all the classes, genders, and so on, that the police was using. And for them, it was not only about, I'm going to torture to get your password, I'm going to torture to get this video, but it was also a torture as a revenge. Like, I'm going to torture you just because you were against me, you know? And this was completely fine. This was normalized up to the extent, as I was saying, you would have videos at the state TV that show tortured people, right? And this became, like, slowly, step by step, to the extent where these days, when if people are getting tortured in Belarus, a lot of Belarusians consider it like, oh, this is a daily routine. You know, like, this is what happens to Belarusians who are protesting. This is what happens to Belarusians who are opposing the regime. And this is like a new reality that we had to face, but this is also a new reality that the Belarusian police find itself, where they can do whatever the fuck on earth they want with the prisoners, and they will have no consequences. Even quite often, when the people are dying, there is no consequences for the cops. There is also a notion of a collective responsibility introduced in the society. So even the relatives of opponents of the Belarusian regime are becoming targets these days. So you have quite a bunch of people, like hundreds of thousands of Belarusians, who left the country in the last years because of the political reasons. But their families are in the country. And a Belarusian regime perfectly understands that this is a leverage for controlling the people. So many people prefer to stay actually in the shadow if they're politically active, or to completely stop being politically active, because this can bring not only troubles to them, but also to their relatives. The relatives would lose their working places, they will lose the place they're studying, and in some worst cases, they will be prosecuted and sent to prison. So this is also happens, and you don't need formal reasons. Like, you can generate enough formal reasons in Belarusian state to put a person in the prison. Another thing is that Belarusian regime in the last years started understanding the value of lawyers as a small bridge between the outside and the people who are sitting in the prison. So they started actually prosecuting quite a bunch of lawyers. In general, in Belarus, you don't have, let's say, political lawyers. You don't have, like, leftist, anti-fascist lawyers who would be doing political prosecution of the activists, but you do have quite a bunch of people who are, let's say, sympathizers, or they believe in the right of law and so on and so forth. And they were usually like supportive of the people who were prosecuted politically, and those people were the first targets. So those people who sympathize with the opponents are the first targets to get prosecuted. Some lawyers got arrested. Most of the lawyers lost their license, as the Belarusian state can easily withdraw your law license. So this became like a new thing. For like on a mass scale, to give you an example, in the last 2 years, 15 lawyers that were like in one way or another supporting anarchists or working with anarchists in Belarus lost their licenses, and that's like a fucking massive amount of people. And now, if you have like lawyers who are working with the prosecuted anarchists, they are like less and less interested in public support, in solidarity work, and they're just trying to keep their mouths shut. Yeah. As for situations in Belarusian prisons, this is like another different topic to talk about. This can be like another presentation. I will give you just a short introduction into Belarusian prison system, as it is not like what you have in Germany, which a lot of Belarusians can consider, oh, German prisons are very nice. Just bizarre concept, right? You have like a system of repressions against the society, and then people come and like, oh yeah, this is better than my fucking dorm in Belarus. But in general, a Belarusian prison system is something we inherited from the Soviet times. So maybe some of you read about Gulag system and all these prison camps that were distributed. So Gulag was abandoned somewhere like in the 50s, I think, of the last century. But the way the punishment system was organized continued in the same way and is still there, with prison camps where people are living in the barracks and they are supposed to be working the whole time for the sake of the greatness of the Belarusian state or whatever shit. Before it was for the proletariat and blah, blah, blah. But these days it's just Belarusian state. So people are working all the time, and this is like how prisoners live. They live in a bigger prison population of maybe 100 people that quite often interacting with each other and so on and so forth. And if prisoners are not very, let's say, cooperative with the prison system, they can be transferred to the prison houses, which you know like from the pop culture, you know, like a prison house where people sit in the cell for 23 hours out of 24 per day and so on and so forth. But Belarusian prisons is not such an easy, like, you know, okay, this is that's it, that's how people live. Rather, that the time you spend in prison is a time you actually struggle against that system, because the system is constantly trying to crush you, to destroy you mentally, physically. And if you're a political prisoner in Belarusian prison system, then you are like exposed to extra pressure inside of the prisons. And one of the examples is that a normal Belarusian prisoner is allowed to have, let's say, 3-4 food parcels per year, where you would get like basic things you need. Belarusian prison does not provide a proper food. Like with the Belarusian prison food, you will get fucked, like your health will get fucked. So a lot of people are very dependent on that. And what happens to Belarusian political prisoners is that they are losing that packages. They cannot actually get their food parcels on the regular basis, and then the prison's administration would actually take away those. And it's quite often that people won't get any parcels from their relatives for a year or even more. Right? This is one of the ways to put pressure. The other thing is, and it differs a lot from, let's say, Western punishment institutions, is that in Belarus, the amount of visitations are very limited, and it's quite often like your relatives can visit you 3-4 times again per year, and it's only close relatives, so only your parents, spouse, and maybe brother, sister can visit you in the prison. No friends, nothing like that. And this is also creates a huge, let's say, pressure, because those people are so important for you to build up this bridge to reality, that you are quite often confirming to what the prison administration wants. And they are quite often taking that away from you. So if like we take anarchist prisoners, for example, there are certain prisoners who didn't have visitation from their relatives for half a year, for 9 months, and so on and so forth. And this is a strategy of the Belarusian punishment system to break the people's spirit, right? then if people are not really cooperative inside of the Belarusian prison system, then, as I was saying, they can be transferred to high security prisons, and it's, as I was saying, this kind of a pop culture prison, but on the other side, it's a high security prison. So you get like the guards who are basically in the torture mode the whole time. They're trying to figure out how to fuck up your life on the hourly basis. They are not letting you live in the prison cell. They're constantly figuring out how to deal with you when you are in the prison cell, right? And if this is not enough, a lot of Belarusian colonies and Belarusian prisons have extended punishment cell, which is like a solitary confinement, but there is a huge difference to, let's say, there is a certain difference to other solitary confinements around the world. Belarusian solitary confinement is again built after the Soviet times, and the idea there is again to punish the person with even more torture, right? So if the person is doing something wrong in the inside of the prison system, then we are going to punish him or her. And then we have situation where quite often this solitary confinement doesn't have any heating. This solitary confinement doesn't have any chairs or tables or anything like that. There would be no bed, but just a wooden stage, so to say, that you can use only for 8 hours from 10 till 6 in the morning. And these cells are also getting very hot in summer, so it's like a torture with heat, a torture with cold, and to understand what is torture with cold, right? When outside of your window is maybe, let's say, minus 20 degrees, the window is broken or the window is there, but there is no heating. What happens to your body is basically you're freezing, right? And you don't have warm clothes on you, and the only way to go through that cold is constantly movement, right? You have to fucking move, you have to burn calories, you have to keep your body warm. And what was an example of our comrade who was in one of those cells in last winter, he told, okay, I actually can sleep for 15 minutes, and then I wake up, I do exercises for half an hour, and then I can sleep for 15 more minutes. And that's my rotation for the whole night. And then you can be in the cell for 15 days. And the only thing that keeps people alive in those prisons, the only reason why people are surviving those, is just their will to live. You know, like, you have to be very strong to continue doing that. You are not in desperate giving up and just stop doing those exercises. You continue doing the fucking exercises. You continue to warm up, because that's like, you are fighting with that fucking regime. You are fighting with that torture. Yeah. Another thing what Belarusian state is doing is color labeling the prisoners. Germans might know about that from the concentration camps. This is not a concentration camp, but the idea there is kind of bizarrely close to each other, right? So we have this prison population, and we want to make prison guards aware which prisoners are in which category, so the prison guards can easily decide how much violence they can use against the prisoners, which rules are applied to those prisoners, and so on and so forth. And for so-called extremist prisoners, there's a yellow mark. The Belarusian regime was using the marking from 2015, but this was mostly used against the drug users. After 2020, you have like thousands and thousands of prisoners who are wearing this yellow mark inside of the Belarusian prisons. And what it means for a lot of prisoners is that in many colonies, political prisoners are not allowed to communicate with the general prisoner population, or you get punished with the solitary confinement. Political prisoners are not allowed to communicate with each other, so like you're getting completely isolated, and the cops know about that, and there are a lot of other rules that are making your life like even more under control of the state in colonies, in prisons, and allow the Belarusian state to prosecute people for being extremists inside of prison way easier. This is an example of a person who got out of the prison, and she like kept her tag just to show to the others, and it's basically her surname saying, yeah, and that's it. And all the prisoners are supposed to have it all the time on, that the prison guards can see it. Yeah. Now, I'm jumping to something that was quite soul-crushing, let's say like that, and fucking crazy, and is fucking crazy, is war in Ukraine. So we have this situation where for almost 2 years, we are struggling with these repressions, we are trying to reorganize ourselves, and then this fucking Putin decides to go one step further and do the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and Belarus becomes a very important territory for that. I don't know if you've heard, but there were a lot of tanks, there were a lot of troops that were passing through Belarus, and Belarus became a very important ground for the operation of conquering Kyiv. So you had tanks passing by, you had helicopters, planes, rockets, everything was there. And this, like, twisted quite a lot our own reality, because we were, you know, like, brewing in our small Belarusian reality where we're all getting fucked by the regime, but we are still struggling, and then, like, this big brother just fucking comes and, you know, like, knocks you out and says, fuck that old shit, I'm going to destroy everything. And of course, war in Ukraine created a lot of problems for the resistance against the Belarusian regime on top of that. What happened in the first days was that despite all the repressions, despite all the violence that the Belarusian regime was using against the people, thousands of people went on the streets in Belarus, right? Thousands of people tried to stop it, which is a desperate move. Like, there is no fucking way even the whole Belarus uprising would stop Russian invasion of Ukraine, because Russia invades Ukraine and Belarus is just like a small gig on the side. Although Belarusian regime plays a very important role in this invasion. But this was very important for a lot of us, that we are continuing the resistance and we are resisting against Lukashenko's regime, and now we are not going to stop because our country is now fully covered with the Russian troops. We're not going to stop our resistance. Unfortunately, those protests were smashed very fast. Like, within a couple of days, there were over 1,000 people arrested, ended up in prison on the short-term arrest. Some of them were sent for the longer prison sentences. So the Belarusian regime didn't tolerate so much of a resistance, right? However, what happened after that, people thought, at least some smaller groups of people thought, there is no way we can affect in any way this war in the bigger groups. We can't go to the streets and fight. What we are going to do, we are going to form up a smaller groups and start doing actions that might affect in one way or another Russian troops. And this was like so-called railroad war. I think a lot of medias wrote about that. Those were like a smaller groups of direct action people who were sabotaging railroad infrastructure. And I think when we are talking about railroad wars, people imagine like a guy with a, or a woman with a hammer, and they're destroying the railroad and so on. This is not the case. The modern railroad is a highly digitalized system, right? And a lot of things that are making it work is actually quite easily destroyed. So people were destroying a booth that were responsible for the distribution of the traffic. And this was a very successful thing to paralyze movement of the Russian troops in the country, where the railroad was very crucial in bringing tanks fast and so on and so forth. And a lot of experts believe that actually the railroad war played one of the key points why Russians failed in their Kyiv conquering trip. Of course, Ukrainians is the first defense line, and they did the most of the work. But because Russians couldn't move through Belarus so fast, they fucking failed it. And eventually, at the end of the day, Russia gave up pretty much having big amount of troops in Belarus. And now there are still like training camps and so on and so forth. But amount of troops that were there in the first months is incomparable to what Belarus has on the territory of Belarus. However, Belarusian regime had to also reply to that sabotage very swiftly, because for Lukashenko this was like, let's say, a smack in the face. Well, he's a respected dictator. He's keeping everything under control. He's talking to his friend Putin in Moscow, right? And Putin is like figuring out what the fuck is going on. So the repressions hit against those groups very hard. And one of the things was that they passed this legislation that I was talking about, that intention of terrorist act would be enough to execute you. And they were sending that message to the people who were doing sabotage, that we are going to kill you. If you continue doing that, we are going to start killing you. And this was, if this was not enough, of course, they were arresting some people. Some people were caught during those actions. And in one of the videos of the arrest, they would have a guy who is like already arrested, and they would shoot him in the legs and send that message again to everybody that we are not fucking around. We are going to shoot you now at the spot if you continue doing that. And this kind of like worked pretty well, as people were not ready for this amount of violence against those actions, like taking account what they were doing. They were not, you know, hunting like Russian generals or something like that, like partisan warfare, but they were destroying infrastructure. So for a lot of people, this was enough repressions to actually withdraw from the country and escape from the country. The railroad war continues. It goes on in Russia right now. There are even like some Belarusian groups that are working in Russia at this moment. But in general, like in Belarus, it is pretty much died out because the repression apparatus worked pretty well in crashing it. Lukashenko and war. Actually, this slide was done before Prigozhin did his trip in the sky. As you might have heard, Prigozhin tried to become new Putin, right? And he was marching to Moscow, and we were all holding fingers that the fuckers will kill each other and the world will become a better place. It was very exciting for a lot of people all around the world. And it was like a horrible moment when Prigozhin said, "No, I'm done here." And Lukashenko played an important role. Nobody fucking knows how important this role was, but he was saying like, "Hey, I called Prigozhin. I called my friend Prigozhin. I told him, hey, give up this plan, and that's it, right?" And Prigozhin said, "Of course, Lukashenko, Alexander, you are like a very smart person. I'm not going to go to Moscow." That's the story, right? What happened after that is history. But in general, the relationship of Lukashenko and war is a little bit more complicated. Lukashenko understands from one side that Russia didn't win the war like that, as Putin was promising. 3 days in Kiev turned into, I don't know, maybe never in Kiev. Hopefully never in Kiev. No, like fucking never in Kiev. Putin will step, yeah. But Lukashenko sees that, right? This is not working for Putin. This is not working for Russian regime. He's not fucking stupid to jump into the war where on the side of the losing, right, part. And he's doing quite a lot trying to sneak his way out. You know, like, okay, we can do this, we can do that. And he's playing an important role for Putin because Belarus is one of these countries that provide a way around for the sanctions. So you can buy some drone parts and bring them to Belarus and send them to Russia and things like that. So Lukashenko has his role, right? But he's also sometimes playing the role of this like warlord. Like if the Ukrainians are going to continue resisting, if they try to fuck with us, we are going to like start the war. So this kind of like starts from time to time, but in general, Lukashenko doesn't seem to want to join that war. And the story with Prigozhin also showed that Lukashenko doesn't have so much of political power in the region anymore. He was saying that he's a guarant, how is it called fucking in English? Like he was guaranteeing the safety of Prigozhin. He said, "Come to Belarus and we will take care. Nobody is going to kill you." What happens next? A couple of months later, Prigozhin is dead. And that basically undermines anything Lukashenko says, as if we didn't know. Lukashenko shit talks a lot, right? This is clear. But at the same time, on the public arena, on the political sphere, if somebody like so high in the political authority says this is this, and then it's just completely destroyed by another state, it shows that Lukashenko has very little grasp on his power. He's not deciding so much outside of Belarus within like the bigger picture of the war between Ukraine and Russia. And he doesn't decide so much inside of the country as well, as Russia controls quite a lot. Yeah. And I mean, one guy's down, let's hope that the other one will fly plane badly also. Another thing what happened was that when the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started, there were a lot of Belarusians in Ukraine at that point. And the important part here was that a lot of those people already escaped authoritarian regime before, right? So Belarusians had to move out of Belarus because of the protests, because of repressions. And when they faced another wave of this fucking threat, of this violence, of this destruction, a lot of people said, no, I'm not going to go anywhere. Of course, the easiest way for a lot of people to say, move to Poland, move to Germany, whatever, but for a lot of people, this would be enough. Like, there is a certain limit of retreat that you can do before you decide, I'd rather fucking die than make another step back. Right? And for a lot of Belarusians, this was like the situation. So a lot of Belarusian people who were in Ukraine joined volunteer battalions to fight back Russian troops. A lot of Belarusians joined volunteer groups that were providing evacuation of the, let's say, people in the war zones or in the zones where the Russian troops were advancing and doing the medical care and so on and so forth. So Belarusian people like spread it all around, doing all the volunteer work together with a lot of like way more Ukrainians, of course, but people were there. And also a lot of people who were already in Poland and in many other countries decided to go to Ukraine because for them it became like the struggle of their life, right? It's not only about fighting in Belarus because you're Belarusian, but it is about fighting Belarusian regime. It is fighting about against Russian regime that made Belarusian regime possible in the last years. So a lot of people joined the volunteer battalions. And unfortunately, most of those Belarusian battalions are organized around groups with like right to the extreme right ideologies that try to, let's say, capitalize politically on the crisis. But the people who are fighting in those battalions, most of them, like majority of the people who are fighting, are the people with like no political intentions that would lead to some kind of extreme right perspectives and so on and so forth. Yeah, so Belarusians are still like one of the major groups that are fighting against Russian invasion, one of the major foreign fighting groups that are fighting against the Russian invasion, and continues happening. In general, what is important here is that as for like as anarchists, as Belarusian anarchists, we believe that war is horrible. Like, there are certain people who believe that we, because we are like supportive of Ukrainian people, we are like fucking warmongers and we love war and so on. No, there is no fucking world in which war is a good thing. And Ukrainian war like took down lives of so many people and so many beautiful and great people that it will like, it is a wound that will not heal for generations, right? But at the same time, this wound is something that teaches us a lot, and also this war shows us that, or not shows us, but created a situation where the situation will change for sure. It is not a permanent, let's say, status where the war will be going on and on and on, and the things will get worse and worse and worse. We believe that this war will be over and the Russian regime will be fucking crushed. And in that case, when the peace comes, there will be space for political changes. And we believe that those political changes will be done by the people who are participating in the struggle against that war. And there is nothing, you know, like nothing more direct action in the struggle against the war is actually trying to stop this war. And for me and for many of our comrades, anarchist comrades who are fighting in Ukraine right now, stopping this war is stopping Russian invasion. And that's like the only thing that we can do, actually. So next time you hear about, you know, people calling for peace, like Wagenknecht or some other popular Germans, peace have always conditions, right? And those conditions can be destroyed, can destroy societies, can destroy peoples, can lead to such changes that we will never be able to recover. So for us, if there is no justice, there is no peace. I will jump shortly to talk about comrades in Belarus who are mostly right now in prisons, talking about the anarchists, like the biggest, let's say, present group of anarchists right now is sitting in prison. There are over 30 people, anarchists and anti-fascists, who are struggling on the daily basis against the Belarusian regime in those prisons. That's like an important fact to understand, not only in Belarus. So next time you read about the prisoners here and there, hackers prisoners, anarchist prisoners, doesn't matter who, whistleblower prisoners, those people are struggling. They ended up in prison and they're not living in a happy house. They're continuing their struggle, and we are here as a solidarity structures to support that struggle, to continue that struggle, because this is not an easy way, you know, an easy life, and you make a break from your activism when you go to prison. There is Anarchist Black Cross Belarus, that's us, mostly in exile because of the political prosecution. So we are not sitting in Belarus anymore, unfortunately, with the hope to fucking return to our home at some point in the future. Pramen Collective is like an anarchist communist group that is also doing a lot of media work. You might have seen them because they're translating some stuff into English quite often. Yeah. Then there is out of this big chunk of people who moved to Warsaw, there is a group of anarchists, like a group of Belarusian anarchists in Warsaw, that's how they are called, very creative, but they call themselves like that, and they are doing quite a lot of work with Belarusian diaspora. In Warsaw, Belarusian diaspora is massive, and it's one of the few places where diaspora maintains to be like, maintain the political content and stays political. So those people also exist, and there are quite a lot of Belarusian anarchists spread all around Europe in different parts, in different cities and so on. So the movement is still there, although the longer passes for the people in immigration, the less hope there is that, you know, one day we will be able to come back and build up like a fucking anarchist republic in Belarus. Yeah. As for anarchists in prison, this is our main focus. Unfortunately, this slide comes last, normally, like in the last part, when there is not so much time to talk about it. So I'm not going to go in details about each person. You can come to me at the info table we have outside. We have also posters with those people, so you take them to your home and they will be looking at you, judging and reminding you that you have to donate and support them and write them postcards and so on and so forth. But to talk like about a couple of people, all of them like came to end up in the prison in a very different ways. They had long lives of struggle, of love and hate and parents and so on and complications. Now they are there. Anastasia Kuchta, for example, is a great comrade of ours who was participating in organized neighborhood assembly in her part of Minsk, was doing like a massive work and ended up in prison for that kind of work, and also for calling to sanctions, I believe, and stuff like that. Then there is the Pramen case. There are like four anarchists who ended up in prison for allegedly being part of Pramen Collective, who is considered an extremist formation. But reality here is that all of them participated in the protests actively. So this was the reason actually why they were arrested in the first place. And then the state just put it on them, whatever they wanted to do. Then there is the case of Belarusian anarchist partisans, an anarchist who actually took weapons and took, let's say, certain explosives, and went to attack infrastructure of the Belarusian repressive regime, like a prosecutor's office, burned down some cars, police stations, and so on and so forth, and got arrested in the middle of the forest at the border between on the Belarusian side, at the border between Belarus and Ukraine, as they were trying to go to Ukraine at some point. The case of anarchist criminal organization, also an example of how Belarusian regime is working in the repressions. So they took like a lot of anarchists from different parts of the country, from different even historical bits, where some people, for example, at the point of their arrest didn't consider themselves anarchists anymore, but they did some actions before. They dropped all of that in one pot and said, this is like an international criminal organization and you are all part of it and we're going to prosecute you for that. And then sentencing is basically based on what they decided you be like in the hierarchy of that organization. And the actions that were in that case, like in the criminal case, were actions that were done in the past 10 years. So basically, you take all the actions of anarchists that are somehow criminally prosecuted, drop them in this pot, drop people inside, shake it, and then decide that those people will go to prison for this and this people go to prison for that. There are also some anti-fascists in Belarus still. Those guys ended up in prison for attacking the cops. There was a situation where there were like civil cops sitting in the car during the big demonstration, and they just went to the car and were like knocking on the window, most probably, and just pepper spraying the fuckers so they could just fuck off while the protest is happening. Yeah. So those are the prisoners. You can learn more about them on our website. We try to write updates about the people, about their conditions, because Belarusian prison conditions are very harsh. And if you're anarchist, you are getting like extra punishment inside of Belarusian prisons. Just check out the website if you're interested in that, or some social networks where the updates are coming, mostly in Russian or in Belarusian, but there are automatic translations that are doing quite a good work to get at least bits of information. How to help? I hope you are very excited to help Belarusian anarchists, to help anarchists Black Cross Belarus. You can donate. One of the reasons why these presentations are happening, it's kind of like agitative time when we are trying to, you know, like empower you, give your fucking 1 monthly salary to the cause in Belarus. ABC Belarus is working only on the donations. We do not get any foundation from European Union and blah, 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 and all this bullshit. Rather, we are dependent on the comrades, and we believe that solidarity is like a work of everybody. Maybe not so much as we are doing, but there are certain very simple things you can do that will make a difference. And there are a lot of money required for the lawyers, for the food parcels, for the families of the people in prison. You can donate at the info table that we have outside. There is also merch that you can buy, you know, like to satisfy your consumerist soul. So feel free to do that. And yeah, please also mobilize your parents, anybody who has money, those people who don't have money but go to buy beer, like, no, stop, don't buy beer, donate to ABC Belarus, and then buy beer if you have something left, if you want. But like, it's very crucial for the survival, not only of our group, it is very crucial for the survival of the comrades, so they see that they are not left alone in the struggle. There is nothing like, there, like, it's very crushing when you start feeling inside of the prison that there is nobody who cares about you outside. And one of the ways is actually through, like, okay, somebody's paying for my lawyer, somebody's helping my family, I know that the comrades are taking care of that. Spread the word. It's also very important, knowing the mistakes that were made by the anarchists in Belarus, but also knowing about the struggles that are happening. I think for me, here is a very important to point that we are not victims of the Belarusian regime, who are like very, you know, poor people. You come to me after presentation, you pat me on the fucking head and say, you poor Belarusian. We are fighters. We are anarchists because we are fighting, and we believe in our struggle. We believe that the world will be a better place without Lukashenko's dictatorship, without the centralized state infrastructure and things like that. And I think for me, this is a very important part. When you spread that information, you spread information not about the poor creatures who are all the time fucking victims of the state, but rather the people who are fighting, and they're sometimes not in the winning position, but they are fighting, and they're not giving up. Send letters to the anarchists in prison. Unfortunately, most of the anarchists do not get letters from outside, only from their mother, father, or sister, maybe. But we have a form on our website where you can put your message. It might be not so long, like a long, complicated letter, but a smaller message, and we will pass that to our comrades in the way we can. So this is one of the ways you can pass the message of support, of solidarity to our comrades, especially, for example, when they have birthday, or you have, I don't know, holidays like New Year holiday, and so on and so forth. It's very important to remind that, again, like, there is this warmth that is coming from outside. It's actually like one of the, you know, like prison jargons. When people are getting something from outside, like food or something like that, when you're in prison, it's actually called to warm up in Russian. Like, so you are warming up those people with the food, with the clothes, and so on and so forth. Yeah. We also have a system of like prisoner supporters. And we encourage anarchist organizations or liberal organizations or whatever organizations to take over support of one prisoner, two prisoners. Each prisoner has like a certain amount of money that needs to be spent per month to pay again for the lawyers, to pay for travel costs for their families, to visitations, and so on and so forth, food parcels. And those are a lot of money. And we, of course, collect a bunch of money, but still it's very important for us that this solidarity is not one time, but rather it happens on the regular basis. Here it's written patrons. This is like a bad language. The slide was not updated. We call it supporters. We see it as part, like you're becoming part of that struggle. And to understand it, you've seen some people were sentenced to like 10 years in prison, 20 years in prison. I don't fucking know how long I will survive my activist life under this level of stress. So I might be not alive in 5 years, you know, but our comrades are still in prison and we hope that we will get them out in 2 years. But we still need people who will do this continuous work and actually provide that support, at least financially, to our comrades. Yeah. As the last word, again, this presentation is done not to tell you the story about some exotic land, although it's in the fucking Eastern Europe, it's like just 1,000 kilometers, and most probably you've never been there. But it is to tell the story about the struggle that is integral to the struggle of the whole world. We are not fighting only for our own freedom in Belarus, we are not fighting for the freedom in Ukraine. We are fighting for the just world, for the world where people are free and not in this, you know, like Fortress Europe conditions where there is like a golden million that enjoys certain freedoms and likes to live in their posh houses and shit like that. But rather, we continue our struggle in the places where we are, in the places that are not so economically flourishing or quite exploited and quite harsh in the way we can live it through. And I hope that this struggle can actually encourage you here to understand that what you have here is such a privilege that you can use to change not only the way you live here, you personally, in the group level, in the bigger level, but you can actually be part of the struggle outside of the so-called first world. Join the struggle of the anarchists in Belarus, or join the struggle of the anarchists in Ukraine, or in Hong Kong, or in fucking Syria. We are all around the world, and we are not these bizarre creatures that are just, you know, striving for some bullshit from the propaganda, but we are revolutionaries that believe in freedom, that believe in true freedom that is written on the pages with blood, you know? And this blood is poured on a daily basis by your comrades all around the world. So I hope you will continue contributing to this struggle with all the energy and power you have. Thank you very much.
Really, really thank you for the talk and your work. Yes, do you have any questions?
We have like, as I think from the time schedule, we have 10 minutes max.
Yeah.
Microphone here, and I come to you for your question.
Hello. I came Hello. Too late. I want to know your name and the name of your organization.
Okay. My name is Boris, and I'm part of the Anarchist Black Cross Belarus. And this is an organization that does solidarity work with anarchist anti-fascist prisoners, but also does a critical work on not reforming, but abolishing the prison industrial complex.
I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say thanks a lot, and thank to all of you for doing this work. I think also, you visualizing how repression is working in Belarus is showing me that the escalation spiral that we're also seeing right now within Fortress Europe is for me going in that kind of a direction. So it's like scary and really good to see that people still keep on fighting and supporting each other. Thanks.
Right. Thanks a lot.